three short poems. Okay, the first one is based on a recent relationship I had, and it was all email correspondence. But there was a certain nagging problem.
You haven't got that much time, Alexa. You haven't got that much time.
Will you not give me your number? It puts our correspondence in such a slumber. I have that impotent frustration, like when a cat crawls out a tree, knowing I cannot text you, and you cannot text me. We could make up some rule to which I would adhere, that I would only text you when some time is near, to invite you when I'm getting ready to go out for a ball, or the opposite, I can only text you when I'm wearing very little at all. Whatever, if there's a rule, I'll keep to it very well. But normally I despise, I keep to it well enough, but normally I despise being at the mercy of such stuff. Otherwise I have to find second hand for some of them, and I think this underlines and some inherent flaw. Why do friends more mediocre deserve it more? So give me your number. Give me your fucking number. Okay, this one is part from my writing a poetry book. It's called The Epistle to the Sea. The sea, the terrible sea, it shows its rage and lament to me, its implacable and fierce force, where wind and my breath divorce, yet still is growing itself, not knowing its violent, persuasive power. And the sea with each boiling surge, that both air and drowning merge, and a horrible clapping ringing, speaks with a wild singing, from the loose and flailing rigging, it is a water deck you're digging. I'm struggling on deck to breathe, whilst the waters around me seethe. I'm in the middle of nature's hate, the most dangerous showing of its being innate. If not indeed a place for mortals, this is seen through which a power portals. As Moses to God it speaks to thee, I am the sea, the terrible sea, who is deep yet without man's mercy, and you will yet die or yet fear me. Here only death can transport one to peace, its momentum of war it could not cease, and to only the surest sailor does it before, the luck to pass and live through all. And this is for everybody in the poetry group. It's called The Poet's Worth. We are always more deeper than we seem. We poets are awake whilst others dream. The strongest validity of our feeling is given to a solid heart unreeling. Indeed, the rescue of one's spirit is placed higher than all their wit. We walk in blessed beauty, but see it as a painful duty. What is accepted we can dissemble, we can stare at stars until they tremble. We are a fairy race of people, at the peak of the point where high minds do steeple. But what is our inscrutable worth? We are priceless in the penniless earth.
I should maybe have said you want to keep it small but shorter. It is going like 20 past 11 and all that crap. Never mind that. Here's Billy Ramsey. All right.
Hello. How's it going? This is Paul Road, 12 years ago, July 2001, down in Baltimore. A bunch of friends. Bums call with summer come to place. So in Baltimore, a bunch of friends. You come to certain moments in life where you realise that a phase of life has ended and you must people disperse and whatnot. And that happens every now and then, not just when you're young. And or so I'm told. And you gotta put in the coin and start the game again, right? The world was mellowing. This is McCarthy's Bar in Baltimore. Great pub. It's gone now. It's too late. You missed it. The world was mellowing and turning gold. Relishing pints, the first sips, fizzing bitterness. And the black surge dozing the throat. We sat near the window in McCarthy's Bar. Savored the hangover, soothing smell of fish. Boats bobbing. Washes of sun haze touching the water. And the clouds, drifting tatters, cobwebs in a sun-filled attic, complex, light-kissed, and infinitely fragile. They say we shouldn't look for analogues in nature. But who can blame me for seeing our lives in those clouds? For even then, our teeth deep in the ripening afternoon, I realize how vulnerable and strange and one-off our hours together were. That our lives are sculpted like clouds in the wind by lust and departures and failure and love. By politics, the bomb, the built-in obsolescence of the species. That a life without Lou was only around the corner. An end to driving westward, to nothing to do. To Miles Davis's kind of blue. To Beck, to Bach, to Leonard Cohen. To Bonnie Billy, to Nina Simone, to George's Key and Foot Massages. To the picture you drew of me unawares, smoking the herb. To Medicine, the Malaysian crew. Rory sculpture, Steve's guitar, Django's blue drag. To us crossing half of Europe to meet you in Prague at 4 p.m. on the 4th of September. A rendezvous you were certain we'd never remember. To the lazy summers that so sneakily flew. To hours of stargazing flat on our backs in my back garden wet with dew. To College Road, to Dutch Gold, to Six for a Fiver. The hours of gazing at the river grope its drunken meander through UCC, to Murphy's Black Russians GMT, on Brogue, the Oval, the Gateway Bar, on Spalpeen Phonic, to the life-restoring Sunday Jar, to the hangover soothing smell of coffee and bika on a Sunday morning, scrambled eggs, banoffee, croissants, ciabatta, chicken tikka, to the salad antiseptic, ghost-ridden shell, that's all that's left of the bika, that our lives, our friendships, our sturdiest loves are no more solid or stable than this already vanishing, never to be repeated, no, at this table, than the spasming tang of stove on my tongue, than that cloud, than that delicate flake of cloud, or this cloud-filtered spillage of sun, than this woven rework and rewoven poem that is home for a moment to this precious few, and this precious few, Brian and Rona and Billy and Gavin and Bar and Lou. All things must pass, the old masters love to tell us. I took my glass and sank the bitter dregs, and suddenly drunk and bitter walked out along the pier, and searched for a poem, a prayer, a formula of words, to make it all as transparent and recurring and uncomplicated as the sunlight in dying slants caressing the water, as the water, viscous, thick with life, lustral, murmuring amber, as the music of the gulls above the water, or the gulls upon the murmuring water.
Next we have our five-word challenge winner, Richard Hoffmeyer.
This is called Risk by Anna Santos O'Connor. Gathered in the Moorish porch at Bristol, shuffling their fragmentary ocean charts, merchants stride towards freshly tarred vessels. Those shore feet pound a jig on the gunwales, spiced with the ebony musk of plunder. On the strand at Yule, two children unlatch our camera shutter, insouciant as sailors prizing open a gun port before pounding out grape shot in a gale. Still searching for the digital display, one asks, but how will you know if it's good? That is a risk from the past, we mutter. They strike out, strident up the gravel slope, caravels rounding the Cape of Good Hope.
Thanks, Rachel. Now we have Jenna, is it Pink?
Pink. This one related to your line about the robot's footsteps on the grave. And it has to do with pink collar caregivers and thinking about how sometimes their job of women and men working in care institutions is to be a robot on an assembly line. The last hurrah. Unapologetically ousting the caregivers, the robots glided in, twirled around, and sang in their finest, freest, holiest voices, "So long, farewell." The caregivers, still in shock, having, well, lost their jobs, limped, stretched their backs, mumbled about compassion fatigue, and reminisced on being employed. Those were the days. The world was our oyster. We didn't know how good we had it, they chimed, romanticizing the days of forfeiting their identities, derailing their visions, mechanizing their movements, and having two lone caregivers support 50 elderly residents. The CEO announced he was letting his caregivers retire early, setting them up with a generous severance package, a couple sleeping bags, a list of transitional shelters, and a guide to selling their scrubs on eBay. They'll get top dollar if they ship overseas, he vouched. Trust me, there's life after burnout. At first, I liked the novelty. The robots skated from room to room, danced, curtsied, gently caressed my body, and greeted me with royal poise, saying, "Madam, shall we dine? May I assist with your shower? Tea is served. Would you care for a eucalyptus-scented washcloth?" I was Queen Elizabeth, basking in the glow of my royal robotic helpers. Gliding, sidestepping, and figure-eighting, one robot landed a triple axle loop in left sequence without breaking a sweat, pulling an electronic hammy, or dropping the bag of adult diapers she was carrying. "What a performance," I yelled, practicing my royal wave. Lubed up, pampered, and polished, I eventually started missing human contact. "This is humiliating," I moaned, craving the basic, I mean basic, human right to recognize my debilitating, frail old self in a young, desperate caregiver. In a caregiver bending herself over, shouldering personal responsibility for an unjust system, and manifesting my pain. Do you know how humiliating it is to be the only vulnerable person in the room? Do you know how humiliating it is to be the only person in the room without dignity? I asked. Well, a robot clapped, pirouetted, and offered me a breath mint. What a performance.
Thanks, John. Next we have Mary Coveney.
Two short ones, that's okay. And there's a bit of a link here as well, in a home. It's called Last Phase. Late quarter moon, whetted sickle hands. Slants through sealed windows on the old, folded in deep velour chairs, backs to the wall, silenced by a giant TV blaring the pathos of soaps. On occasional tables, silk amaryllis trumpet their permanent blossoming. On the rack, Hello magazine are flagrant with youth, as moonlight caresses a frail woman's head while she's parting her hair back to childhood. And this is feeding time. Beneath blood-red bells of fuchsia, a cat retracts his claws, stretches on a bed of feathers. An old woman plucks soft innards of a loaf, scatters crumbs on the grass. In the pine canopy, cones crack, a warning. Her head swivels as a finch braves the open lawn. From the folds of her black skirt, she takes a wishbone catapult, loads it with a stone, bony finger hooks the band, hitting home between the bird's folded wings that open in last flight. She holds it by a claw, feeds it to her cheekless mouth, cloth an avian gulp.
we have Charles Clark.
Egypt is in the news at the moment, but not for quite the reasons that I would like to talk to this point. From an old land in Egypt, Pharaoh lifted a Nubian dancing girl, a spoon, and stirred his intentions, glancing amiably at his wife, queen and sister.
Okay. Next we have Rosalind Bluth.
As we did a little chapbook together there over the weekend, just thought I'd collect some female woman poems. And I just want to do a really short one. Called Attempt. Here we lie, sweat soaking wet and gasping, side by side, like after a fight, like after the hunt for an unfound centre. And I want to do a love poem as well. some themes that I haven't presented so much. Love poems called. Our love is like an endless rubber band. It spans our time expanding, an infinity that never ceased. It might have paled or even become brittle along the way or overstretched some limits. Like they say, in good times or in bad, it pulled our boat through rough, tough seas. And something happened always, and a rubber band contracted. Closer and closer we came, until infinity was fully aglow between our hearts and bellies, like the rhythm of the sea throughout the years, expanding, contracting, always being there, and infinity aglow with love.
Thanks, Rosalind. Next we have Craig Lambert.
Right. So I'm going to have to read them off this because I didn't know about this till tonight. All my hard copies are back home in England. I like to write poems inspired by quotations. And there's a song on, I think it's on the Beatles' White Album called Revolution 9, which is a very sort of, it's kind of more of a kind of a soundscape. And John Lennon described it as an unconscious picture of what I think will happen when it happens, just like a drawing of revolution. And I kind of thought about writing a poem about revolution, and as Charles said about Egypt, I originally wrote this in 2011, but obviously it's kind of become relevant again. So I'll call it Revolution 13 for today. Of Hepburn hair, Lorraine eyes, Bardo lips, shawl swept arms, slender sandals, black silk, urban smoke, passive aggressive lipsticks, glamour girl clamour, eyeliners for cruise ships, bus busy pyramids, camel hair, goat's milk, spice dust, sickly scent, steamy sweat, canine licks, demigod democracies in sleepy glass cases. King Tut to tap up modern brick Americans, Neolithic Nile bones with $50 faces. Inside, outside, snakes wake, the Sphinx paces. Linen spins them, hands elect electric fans, to size up, surprise, uprise, anachronistic faces. Races. Muslim, mausoleum, muse, musician, museum. Mascara, massacre, masks, masses, disappear to dots. Slow up suns as suns slip on social serum. Still, the guns. Still the guns of disrepair. Still there. still build this human colosseum of Hepburn eyes, Loran lips, hot and Bardo hair. And really quick. This is a poem about my father, an incompetent gardener. It's called The Lord Giveth. The lawnmower wouldn't start. The rockery harbored weeds. The borders were orange clay. And his fork was missing a tang. He dug in frost, planted in gaps, potted up unlabeled seedlings, though they had no chance under the cracked cloche. By June, late frost had gathered its early crop. Fruit trees failed to pollinate. The greenhouse, a stack of unopened growbacks. There wasn't time to tend after work. But a grey desire drove him to drag 10 minutes from the plot at night, as if time was bindweed. Perhaps it was about providence. Even though the lettuce bolted, beans became blackfly, and kohlrabi grew exotically inedible. If there'd been a white rabbit with a stopwatch, or the cats had grinned instead of burying their shit in his resolve, he may have seen God in a potato. Instead, as the annual rose wilted and his 10 tomatoes turned to blight, he planned next year's midnight garden, the one where he could rest in peace. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Conor McManus.
Say happy birthday to Paula.
Yeah.
This is an extract. Oh, he's there, yeah. Paula, happy birthday.
Thank you.
I'd just like to say it's been great. My 4 years in Ovail, I came to Cork and I was welcomed here by Paula and everyone else, and it has really helped me become part of Cork, I suppose. So thanks very much, everybody. This is an extract from a short story, so there's just, I just say, it's about an American naval officer who returns to his home place in rural Ireland and starts, has a relationship with a woman. So there's a sort of a contradictory going on, thing going on there, but just in case you don't get it, that's what it is. As Martin laid back, he followed the wispy clouds wafting towards the mountain. He saw the look on Helen's face as he hauled to the Red Ferguson, right in front of the window where she always sat, jumped down, placed his cap on his head, came to attention smartly, saluted her, and replaced his cap under his officer before entering the hotel and taking his seat opposite her. As he relaxed, he thought of sleep, but it didn't frighten him now, not like it did inside in the cottage, with its low ceilings and darkness falling. His mind went back to Helen and what he'd bring her that evening. Each week, he would rack his brain to try and come up with something different. There were some nice bluebells growing in the shade of the oaks in the fairy ring. They'd be nice, he thought, and he knew she'd like them. Yes, the bluebells. He wanted to bring her something different every time he met her, because every time he met her, she looked different. Even at this stage, when she wore something that she'd worn many times before, she would change it by wearing a different scarf or necklace, or in some little way that he couldn't detect, but she always looked exuberant. Yes, bluebells. He winced as he recalled the time he brought her the fish. 2 big yellow-bellied flat bream wrapped up in newspaper that he unfolded in his excitement on the table in the spring grove before the main course. Needless to say, she never touched a morsel. He should have twigged there was something wrong. Him out on spur all night, fishing, and coming in without an hour's sleep, and landing 2 huge fresh fish onto a hotel table set for dinner in front of a lady. Since that day, he had a fear of losing Helen, or losing his dignity in front of her. That was a bad patch he was going through then. They were blasting the rock on the banks of the canal to widen it for cruisers. He never left the house during the day for 3 weeks while it was going on. It was another 2 months before he went that road again. He asked his neighbour John Francis to keep an eye on the cattle on the hill. And then there was the daisy chain. There must have been about 130 daisies in it. Yes, 130. He'd spent the whole Sunday morning sitting on his topcoat in the meadow at the back of the house picking the daisies. splitting the ends and passing one end through the other. He placed it around her neck as she sat at the table in the spring grove, and he noticed her tremble for a moment as she turned to stare out the window, before kissing him slowly and tenderly on the cheek. It was the first time he'd pulled such a stunt, being so personal as it were, and the first time she'd kissed him. And after that he did away with the mothballs, because his uniform smelled putrid, and he knew she'd be able to smell them. And so he took his uniform out every Saturday night on the dot of nine to air it, draping it across chairs in front of the fire in the wintertime, or hanging it just inside the open front door of a fine evening. Since then, indeed, they kissed in such a manner every Sunday night. She would rise from the table to greet him with a kiss on his arrival. He would place the gift next to her, which she would duly open, and before departure he would stoop to give her a peck in the cheek and thank her for a wonderful evening. That was the story. Martin woke from a restful doze 2 hours later. He checked his watch. It was 0-1200 hours. He'd need to be moving. He had to wash the breakfast dishes and tidy up the place before ironing his uniform. He listened one more time for the pheasant's call before rising, then threw his top coat over his arm and headed down the steep slope diagonally towards the roadside entrance. Back at the cottage, something niggled his mind as he put the kettle on the boil for the dishes. Usually the chores were done first thing in the morning, every morning, but on Sunday he liked to break the routine. On Sundays they were left to the afternoon, and before he'd get ready to go down and see Helen. The niggling continued as he put the pan, grizzle and all, back in the press. He removed the crumb-covered newspaper sheets that acted as a tablecloth, wiped down the table and replaced the sheets with a copy of the latest edition. He studied the room. It needed a sweep. He still couldn't put his finger on what was bothering him. He washed and dried the dishes. His white uniform hung from a nail in a ceiling joist, and taking the tunic, he carefully laid it out on the ironing board. He had the uniform dry cleaned and pressed once a month, but he still felt he had to touch it up with the new iron to sharpen it up. His new iron was a Black & Decker advanced system iron with an extra long cord. He had brought an old shirt to the shop when he was buying it and tested all the gadgets on it before he left. In his underwear and socked feet, he ironed the tunic until it was as crisp as a dried leaf and creased the sleeves until they were razor sharp. The undershirt he buttoned up before sliding it onto the iron board so the sleeves wouldn't touch the ground. He pressed the collar and creased the sleeves before putting it on. The fresh, warm cotton felt good against his skin. He took great care to crease the white pants before he stepped into them. As he retrieved the issue shoes which he'd cared for and maintained all these years, he tried to figure out what was bothering him. It was like fishing, he thought. There was something there, but he just couldn't catch it. The shoes, yes, the shoes. After each rendezvous, he would polish the shoes, wrap them up in brown paper and place them under his bed. Lastly, he ironed the white gloves. He slipped into his shoes, buttoned up the tunic, placed a gold-braided white cap on his head, donned the gloves, and stood for self-inspection in the middle of the kitchen floor. He barked orders in his head. Attention! He came to attention briskly. Hold it! He stood rigid for the self-inspection, and automatically went down through the checklist in his head. Head up, chest out, head and eyes to the front, thumbs down by the seams of the pants, heels together. At ease, soldier. He moved his feet apart into a more comfortable stance, but he didn't relax. The stiff collar of the tunic forced his jaw upward. He adjusted the cap so the gilded signia device of foul anchor, circled with the letters USN, was directly in line with his nose. He patted down the blue boards with the two gold bars that adorned his shoulders. He tugged at the bottom of the tunic, ensuring that the five brass buttons formed a perfectly straight line from his chin to his waist. He picked fluff off the ironing board off the tunic cuff and thumbed the creases of his trousers like a tradesman would check for burrs on a newly sharpened chisel. You'd slice tomatoes on, he chuckled, and moved closer to the mirror. There was still some duck egg on his chin from the fry, which he flaked off with his thumbnail. He checked the distance of his hairline above his shirt collar with two fingers. He'd get a trim during the week. He could give his nose hairs a trim as well. By now it was 1600 hours. It was time he was gone. As he exited, he thought of the bluebells. That was it. Damn, he'd forgotten to pick the bluebells. His mind raced as he tried to think of something to replace them. He could bring her chocolates, but it wasn't the same. He could steal a few flowers from his Conway's garden this side of the town, but that was cheating. The bluebells were in his head. They were fresh and vibrant. Quickly he changed back into his work pants and heavy shoes, hoping that the top half of his uniform would be spared from any dirt he might encounter. Quickly, he took the tractor to the foot of the hill and started his ascent once again. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Steve Nolan.
Yeah. Evening, everybody. It's my first time here. Seems like a nice crowd. This is called Invisible Idiot. There are many types of idiots. I'm sure you've met a few. In my life, I've had the pleasure to bump into one or two. From harmless country bumpkins to demented psychopaths, self-combusting Buddhist monks, and those who bite the heads off bats. But the biggest fucking idiot escapes all our detection, only being visible upon our own reflection. I put the empty carton back in the fridge when I know there's nothing in it. I know all the words to Wonderwall, and I think that I can sing it. I used to think a scholarship was a boat full of students. I've tried to claim back medical fees for my dog's pet insurance. I've been known to piss on toilet seats, but only when I'm drunk. I've convinced myself that I'm not fat, it's just all my clothes have shrunk. I lie in bed for 5 minutes more, even though I know I'm late. From time to time, I find myself in an awful drunken state. I've lost a girl by telling her I love you prematurely. I've had my weekend lying ruined by waking far too early. I've often gone into a shop and forgot what I went in for. I've checked my girlfriend's mobile phone to see who's tried to ring her. I've drank so much it's made me sick. I've been known to be a selfish prick. I don't know what I hate the most, spilling tea or burning toast. If I fuck up or make a mistake, then my own advice I'll never take. But yet still my friends seek my advice. After hearing this, they might think twice. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Stanley Knott.
Thanks, Rob. Don't panic now, Rob. I've got three. Two of them are very short, very short, and the other one is short. And the first two are from a series of poems, or can you even call them poems, from this idea of song titles from artists. So the first one is derived from song titles of Depeche Mode. In your room, a photograph of you, my joy, sweetest perfection. I want you now, dressed in black, breathing in fumes. And then I feel you, see you, but only when I lose myself in a sea of sin. And the second one, you won't be surprised to learn, is a bit darker. It's Nirvana song titles. Help me. Here she comes, the stain, the spectre. Help me, I'm hungry to drain you. Help me, talk to me, rape me. Help me ease the guilt. And then finally, I've been thinking a little while about, you know, what your ambitions were when you were a child and what you'd be when you grew up, if you ever grew up. And then I remember I wrote this a few years ago, kind of. Really does give you an idea of where my ambitions were. Dearest Mr. Wonka, I think that you're the best. You're brilliant. You're the greatest. You're the top of every test. I wish you were my father. I wish I lived with you. My life would then be perfect, and I would never be blue. Oh, Mr. Willy Wonka, I love the way you walk. And Mr. Willy Wonka, I adore the way you talk. And I love the job you're doing, brewing chocolate for us kids. And what a way you do it. It's just brilliant. It's the biz. But if I'm truthful, Mr. Wonka, I love your helpers most of all. the guys who do the singing, and are anything but tall. The Oompa Loompas, oh, they're magic, they're magnificent, I say. I'd sacrifice my right arm to be one, just for a day. Yes, I'd sacrifice my right arm for a chance to sing the songs the Oompa Loompas sing while working in your factory all day long. And I'd gladly lose a leg too if you would allow me join the fun they always have when dancing, when a new recipe is done. See, that is why I'm writing, Mr. Wonka, to you know. I want to be a Loompa, and I need to know just how. I go about applying for the greatest job on earth, being an assistant to a genius on the perfect chocolate search. So, Mr. Willy Wonka, tell me what I need to do, and tell me really quickly, because I'm desperate to work for you. Yours, anxiously awaiting for a swift reply, Stanley Knott of Cork in Ireland. P.S. Please give me a try.
Okay, folks, last but not least is Cal Boyle.
I once got an email from a woman whose name was Dexterous Squirrel, and she was inquiring whether I wanted to grow my penis. So I kept getting these emails off these really oddly named women, so I wrote a sequence of dramatic monologues. I'll read one. It's called Suggestive Seat of Flame. Dear sir, please feel free to devour me like you would a cupcake or a kebab with many trimmings. My nation is trapped in its womb of conflict. The sun is blackened by the souls of our slain young men. Do you like my pictures? I am naked just for you, prospective husband 611. The moon is abundant in its punishment. All tides have stopped, that is, except the tide of my sex, winking emoticon, which will drown her genitals before dawn.